Hello everyone, I'm Liz Mosey, I'm an editor at Tortoise, and a warm welcome to CBI at 10. This is the final instalment in a sort of mini-series that we've been doing about the shortages, all different kinds of shortages that are affecting businesses at the moment, from hardcore pandemic world that we've been in for the best part of 2 and a bit years. We're joined by a brilliant array of experts today who are going to share with us their particular perspective on skill shortages, how a shortage of the right skills and people can affect business planning, both in the short and the long term, and successful strategies that they have used to mitigate those potential threats. Before we get stuck into the topic for this morning, I'm going to talk to Matthew Percival, who is the Programme Director of Changing Workforce at CBI. Good morning, Matthew. How are you doing?
Hi there.
Just before we get into skill shortages, which is obviously a big part of your area of expertise in your role at the CBI, is there anything we need to have our radars on for in the wider context? Typically, we just do a little bit of a setup.
One thing just quickly to look out for is tomorrow, where we're expecting to see the government's energy security strategy. Big deal for government because it's about easing reliance on Russian energy, at the same time as delivering on net zero, and at the same time as being mindful of the cost of living crisis that's going on at the moment. So expect to see a greater emphasis on solar energy, on offshore wind. Nuclear will be firmly back on the agenda, and we're expecting the business secretary to announce the setup of Great British Nuclear. In terms of what the CBI is looking to see announced in that strategy, it's a combination of short-term measures and longer-term responses. And in the short term, we're looking for more support for energy intensive industries, as well as more financial support for households to deal with the immediate price rises. But that needs to be matched with a long term strategy that's actually about boosting efficiency, where the cheapest energy is the energy you're not using at all. So a focus on efficiency in the longer term for households. And then the wider longer term business response, well, we're looking to see them accelerating the UK's energy generation capacity. I've said renewables, nuclear, but also making the most of oil and gas assets in the North Sea. And then we're also looking to see progress on the hydrogen economy with an announcement on business models that will make projects viable for investment. And the final thing, we're not expecting to see it tomorrow, but it's a really important part of this mix, which is why I mention it, which is a comprehensive electric vehicle charging infrastructure strategy.
It's a fairly momentous moment when you think about all of the things that it's affecting. And I'm sure that in this session next week, we'll have an opportunity to pick over what we've heard from the government when it comes out next week. So thanks for that, Matthew. Let's get into skills then, specifically shortages thereof. Just give us a sense, Matthew, of what you're hearing from members now, because this is something that we have talked about before over certainly the couple of years that I've been working with you on these sessions with the CBI. And just give us a sense of the shortages firms have been facing across sort of different sectors and some of the things that they've been doing to address these before we get into the specifics of the case studies we've got here with us this morning.
Yeah, we've got obviously three different sectors represented today, but the stories that we're hearing from our members really are right from across the economy. But a couple of statistics to illustrate what we're seeing, because it's coming through in our survey data as well as our conversations with individual businesses. So one from our surveys is 42% of manufacturers are saying that skill and labour shortages are likely to be a factor or are a factor likely to limit their output in the next quarter. So 42%, that's the highest in 50 years we've been collecting that data. The share saying it's likely to limit their business investment is also rising, which is a big concern for us in the context of the push that the CBI has been making about the importance of business investment and unlocking business investment to helping the UK boost its trend growth rate. And as we put it recently, in order to be serious about growth, we need to be serious about business investment. So that's a big concern. We're also seeing similar trends to what we've seen in recent months in the official labour market data. So that's rising employment, falling unemployment. But crucially, we're seeing stubbornly higher inactivity than we had before the crisis. That is people who don't have a job and aren't looking for a job. And there's a range of reasons. lots of them are really understandable. We're never aiming for 0% inactivity in a labour market, but it is higher than it was pre-crisis. And an element of that is a higher cost and an impact of health-related absences. So businesses being able to think about how they support health and well-being at work and support people back to work, whether it's the impact of long COVID or whether it's various other health conditions that are barriers to people being able to play their part in the labour market. I know that's something we've touched on in a few different dynamics of labour shortages, but that still is one of the big shifts that we're seeing in the labour market, as well as a reduced number of workers over the age of 50 who are active in the labour market. So businesses thinking about health and older workers are two particularly ripe areas for intervention based on looking at the data across the economy as a whole. Obviously, at the same time, we've got ongoing labour shortage, you've got ongoing supply chain issues and rising inflation that just sort of adds multiple headwinds to businesses all at the same time when they're trying to deal with this.
Matthew, it's a really tough environment. There's sort of when you outline just in the energy context, there's so much going on. And then when you add in that the sort of evil twins of Brexit and COVID and all that that has meant for supply chain challenges, plus this labour shortages, it's interesting to hear what you say about it tends to be, there's a particular trend for older people and people finding that, you know, for health reasons, they're withdrawing from the labour market. It feels like something that isn't going to go away anytime soon. So I'm delighted that we have, well, first of all, to point to the resources that the CBI have pulled together. So there is great stuff on the CBI website if you want to have a look at specifics, resources, advice, guidance, that kind of thing. There's some really good stuff to explore in the CBI website, and I'm sure somebody will pop a link in the chat. But let's hear from some people who have got some ideas and some experience themselves of how they've tackled some of this stuff. I'm going to start with Lindsay, if I may. Lindsay Winter. Hi, Lindsay, up there in sunny Glasgow. Is it sunny?
Well, funnily enough, Liz, actually is the sun is starting to come out as literally as
I'm glad started. To hear it. I'm glad to hear it. So, Lindsay, your role is your senior manager for inclusion and careers at Virgin Money. Just tell us how, in the context of your business, how have the shortages sort of presented themselves? Mm-hmm. Where have you got the gaps?
Yeah, so I guess one of the key things for us is our broader strategy. So as a bank, our strategy is to be digital first. So we're seeing some of those skill gaps in that technical space. So, you know, digital skills, all the really clever things that happen in the background of platforms for our customers and our colleagues. So, we're really looking at how we can start to fill some of those gaps. So we have the challenge of some real specialised roles that we need to fill, because we're really aligning ourselves to becoming that first digital first organisation. And then we've obviously got low numbers in the UK job market. So it's how do we bridge that? One of the things we've started to do, and part of this is a response to post-pandemic working, is become much more less focused on location. So like lots of organisations, we've looked at how we go back to work sort of post-COVID, and I don't use that term lightly. So we're looking at taking location out of role profiles and adverts and things like that. It sort of doesn't matter for a lot of these types of positions for us. Also, that opens us up to a way more diverse workforce as well, which is fantastic. We look at more innovative ways to reach potential hires. So working with some digital solutions to look at the passive candidate market and how we can make ourselves attractive to those guys. We're also looking at the upskilling of our existing colleague base. You know, we've got fantastic colleagues who are ready to develop and move within their career. So we'll look at how we can use on the job training, our apprenticeship levy access, and actually get colleagues working and thinking in different ways to help us, you know, get to that direction we're looking for. We know that's a gap we've got today, and it's not a quick fix. So we know we've got some things to do that kind of cover both of those. We also have other, you know, challenges where we're looking at things like how we are leaders, how we, you know, we coach more, support different ways of working, different mindsets in our approach to work. But for us, that technical digital gap is a real biggie that we're doing a lot of work in the background on.
Fascinating, Lindsay. I am completely obsessed with recruitment. In fact, I'd like to do just, let's just do one for me. Let's just do a CBI webinar I'm obsessed with it because it feels really difficult to find good people. And you know, there's gazillions of them out there, talented people who would thrive in your organization, who would love it, who'd be brilliant. But finding them still feels really difficult. So on that second thing you listed, the passive candidate market and clever digital ways of finding those people, what sorts of things is that?
Yeah, so we're working with a new partner on this. So we're exploring how do we become, the employer that you might not know you want to work for yet. So how do we work to identify, where do those guys hang out? Where do they get their content? Where do they, where are they on socials? And how can we make ourselves more present there? So we've done a huge amount of work around what we call a life more virgin, so our kind of response to how we work. And we've become, if anyone follows us on LinkedIn, you'll have seen a lot of the things that we share there around how we work differently, much more flexibly. But we look at things like personas of our colleagues, so how can we adapt our working style to those guys. So we sort of know the type of people that are out there, but using the AI and the algorithms and the data that's available to us, it allows us to be really focused. And it's all new, we're just starting this work, it's at really early stages, but our plan is to almost be able to use the data and the insights that we've got to attract the talent to help us then obviously develop and further on that journey. But it's tricky, it's a really big market, it's a really turbulent market. We've got a great brand and hopefully that works for us in lots of those occasions, but talent is tough to get. So we're trying as much as we can to be as innovative as possible and open it up to a range of different talent groups too.
It's interesting to think, if you're recruiting at scale, if you're a large organization and you have lots of vacancies you want to fill, applying some of the tools that your colleagues in the marketing department have been applying since God was a boy is just sort of that the skills are there. You know how to do this stuff, you just haven't applied it in that frame before. It's a really good, interesting tip. I'm going to come back to you, Lindsay, to hear the specifics of your apprenticeships program in a second, if I may. But I'm tempted to come to Ian next to sort of give us a sense of, before we went live, Ian, I asked you about how long has labour and skill shortages been a problem for the construction industry, and you said, well, approximately since 1962, so not a new thing. But Ian Woodcroft, your public affairs manager for the Construction Industry Trading Board, I wonder, just give us a sense of the lie of the land in that very particular sector, which you think is emblematic of what's happening in lots of other sectors too.
Yeah, thanks, Liz, for that. I mean, the story that Matthew's told is the story that's repeated, I think, and seen in construction itself. We estimate in construction that there's going to be growth of just under 6% this year, so really healthy growth, and around about half that again in 2024 and 2025. There's a real strong skills headwind against that. The industry's lost over 7% of its workforce during the pandemic. The labour market is really tight, though, with record numbers of vacancies. There's some 50,000 vacancies in the industry at the moment. And to meet new demand for skilled workers, construction, we estimate, will need to attract around about 43,000 workers a year to 2025. The kind of challenges in terms of the skills we're trying to recruit for, technical and trade skills are really in demand at the moment, particularly bricklaying, plant operatives, dry lining and ground workers to get the buildings built. But in addition to that, there's lots of skills demand at the moment for new health and safety requirements and regulatory requirements as well. What is concerning is there isn't too much demand out there at the moment for training in new green products and practices, and also training in things such as IT software. And that highlights a really big mismatch that's emerging between getting the skills that are required now and thinking ahead in terms of what skills will be needed in the future to increase productivity, support digitization, and actually as the industry moves itself towards net zero. Positive news is construction apprenticeship starts, which fell really heavily during the pandemic, are now getting back to pre-pandemic levels. However, what we're seeing is that employers are looking to really increase their overtime, delay work, outsource it, or not bid for some work because of the volume of work that's coming in and their ability to actually deliver that work. The structure of the industry continues to act as a barrier to skills investment. 98% of the industry is made up of SMEs and micros who find training and apprenticeships a really big commitment. The industry has got long supply chains and large indirect workforce, which further reduces employers' incentive to train. And finally, construction employers also find themselves fishing in a really competitive and too narrow pond and need to attract attract more women and minority groups to address this. I think to achieve this, the industry really needs to improve mental health and experience of the workforce. And so we're really active in that area as well.
I was going to say, you really have kind of, you've got the set in terms of headwinds and challenges, all that heritage. The two things I'd love to just understand a little bit better. I wonder, the 7% of the workforce that have gone, does that feel like that's the sort of, like Matthew was saying, it's the over 55s, perhaps it's people who are leaving the workforce for reasons of health and wellbeing. Is that, does that feel true to you, or is it other reasons too?
Similar to what Matthew's talking about across the whole sector, we face that challenge. But additionally, what's something that's come through the pandemic is we face the challenge of inactive workers as well. So what we're seeing is people who have left the industry, have changed their lifestyle, doing things in a different way. And so the industry has lost part of that worker or all of that worker.
And Ian, the second thing I was going to ask you, which you mentioned towards the end of your response, was this question of diversity. And we've talked about it a lot, and it really matters. But in construction, if I imagine a construction worker, in my mind, I have a white man. I have. So what can you do to shift that? I mean, that is a marketing brief of the century, you know?
It's a huge brief. It's about marketing. It's about the industry making sure it's really clear and forthright in terms of how it actually shows the industry that it's responding to mental health challenges, how it shows that it's a fair, inclusive and respectful workplace. I think another part of it as well is actually, as you say, what is the marketing activity to attract people into it? We know with parents and careers professionals, there's a real perception that academic routes are a route that to take rather than necessarily a vocational route. Yeah. What we have in place with the industry that we've developed to address that is something called Go Construct. Over 1 million people visited Go Construct last year, and of that we chart that 99,000 of them went to their next step in terms of looking at the potential for careers in construction. We are out with industry across schools across the country selling construction, and also in further education establishments selling construction. But we need to make sure that that continues, that careers guidance and government's careers policy enables that. And we also need to develop really good and interesting pathways into the industry that employers buy into. Employers find it a real challenge to take someone on for work experience. We're developing lots of pathways to address that and enable employers to try before they buy as well.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And that Go Construct, that's a digital, that's a web resource, I'm guessing.
Yes, it's a digital online platform. Anyone can access it. There's over 124 occupations listed on it. There's opportunities for young people to test their skills and abilities in construction and what career path they want to try.
Some of this stuff is about storytelling, isn't it? And making it clear that if you go into construction, that's a career. It's not just a thing you do for a short period of time to kind of get the cash in, that there's real development for, beyond those first steps. Thanks ever so much, Ian. It's really fascinating. Robert Skaden, thanks so much for being here. Now, Robert, you're HR business partner at Siemens, so a whole different world again from Virgin Money and from construction that we've heard before. How is Siemens? I mean, you're a massive organisation, and I'm guessing global too. How are the shortages affecting you? How are you thinking about this in terms of frame the problem for us?
Well, it's quite interesting. This, some of the issues that Lindsay and Ian have brought up are also quite recognisable in Siemens as well. So we're a technology company, a digital company, roots still in engineering. So we still have some traditional aspects of what we do, but also a lot of what we're doing is very, very new. So entering new markets, finding new competitors, doing things in a completely new way, but also engineering, for example, that is also an industry that's changed quite immeasurably over the last few years. And I think what we're seeing is, similar to what Ian said, we've had skills and labour shortages for a long time. It's kind of the nature of the beast, I guess. But certainly at the moment, what we're noticing really is the pace of change. It's really, there's so many different factors that are impacting why we're starting to see those shortages in particular. So, of course, you see the changes in technology, digital disruption. Of course, you see, certainly with the impact of COVID, the attitudes to hybrid and flexible working have changed quite considerably. Attitudes, working cultures have changed a lot as well. But also we're seeing it certainly quite an employees market out there. People are seeing opportunities to move on and change, do different things. But also, the cost of living is having an impact as well. And people are thinking, right, I need to protect myself now and in the future. Do I need to go out and look for a higher salary, for example? So yeah, all of these factors all happening at the moment that have a big impact on what I think.
You mentioned before we went live, workplace profiling. So just explain to us, what is that thing? How do you do it? And how does it help you plan for, you know, how your organization is going to evolve?
Yeah, of course. So it's kind of a form of strategic workforce planning, a principle that we've used for quite a few years, but it's very been, you know, we've learned an awful lot from it. We didn't do it particularly well at the start, I don't think, certainly in within my business. But it's kind of iteratively improved, and we've worked out how it works. I think it was always traditionally maybe seen as looking at the numbers, resource planning. It's a job for senior management and HR to come up with and tell everyone else what to do. But very much now it's a big change to that, that while HR and senior management have a role to play in there, you need, you know, your diverse workforce also providing their skills, ideas and experiences in there as well. So kind of running with the process in my business, for example, we invite a number of people from all over our business, different levels in the organisation. So you have graduates, apprentices, engineers, team leaders, representing different job families as well. So finance, from engineering, from customer services, for example, and bring them all together to consider the problem and very much look at some of the bigger picture changes. So not looking initially at detail, but what do we think of those big strategic changes that we can see in our industry or various different industries over the next sort of 3 to 5 years. So looking, you know, 10, 20, 30 years in the future is an incredibly difficult thing to do, and something I don't think we did particularly well at. You can't really see the future, but just looking at a sort of more measurable timescale, there's plenty of things and ideas that people can see coming, changes coming in the industry. Is there something that new technology we're developing? Is there something that we can see our customers are asking for? And getting people together, a very diverse group, to come and think about it. What are those bigger picture changes? And then trying narrowing that down to, if we see that particular strategic change, where do we see the changes in our job roles, our job clusters? What sort of changes do we see? And then trying to work out where we see the changes. What roles do we think we need? What skills do we think we need more of in the future? And sometimes that can, maybe you might see that some roles and some skills we need less of in the future. But naturally, you see some more new emerging skills and others where we need to, we've got a lot, but we need to grow a heck of a lot more in the future.
It's interesting. You're sort of saying that you're trying to design the Siemens of 5 and 10 years away and then build a skills bridge between what have I got now and what am I going to need? And therefore, and I think one of the things, funny enough, we do a lot of work at Tortoise with large global companies in all sorts of sectors, one in particular, oil and gas. And they really are thinking in this in a similar way, because they've got tens of thousands of employees who are doing jobs that literally won't exist in 5 years' time. And they obviously want to retain, a little bit like Lindsay said, you've got talented people who are committed to the cause, who are saying, well, you know, we're not going to just, don't put me in the bin, show me how I can adapt and become useful in a different way. But it is difficult to do that. It sounds great in theory, but it's hard in practice. What tips have you got for people who might be thinking, how do I, you know, pick up, lift and shift a whole bunch of engineers that are working on technology that is going to be obsolete?
I think that the output to the workforce planning process can be useful. You also naturally get some, you know, some key messages cascaded down from senior management. But I think particularly the key is encouraging your employees to you know, trust them to know about, you know, what sort of changes they can see. Encouraging them to go off and try and find other ways of learning. What sort of skills do I think I need in my role? Or perhaps, you know, what sort of other alternatives could I potentially see in the future? I think that's a very, very important thing. So what can we do as an organisation to try and inspire people into thinking, okay, what sort of changes can I see? What sort of things do I need to work and develop in? So you can hear messages from all kinds of different places, but doing things to try and inspire people into what sort of things they can do in the future is particularly important. So you can get things like, you know, lunch and learn, tech talks and so on, where people can, you know, always very, very pleased to talk about what they do and what they see the changes coming in the future and what they're doing to try and you know, find new ways of doing things in the future. Those sorts of things are very useful. Coaching is a particularly important skill as well. It's a, you know, training people to coach their employees is a great way for them to facilitate discussions, to encourage people to come up with their own ideas. And it's certainly a lot more motivating if you thought of your own idea, right, I can see where my role is going in the future. I need to get myself ready for that. I need to go off and do some training, or I need to go off and shadow other people, find some other way that I can prepare myself for the future. And certainly get myself there to do it.
Thank you so much, Robert. There's a brilliant question here. I'm going to put it to Lindsay as a segue into talking about apprenticeships, from Joanna Kerrigan, who said, how do we change the schools, I suppose schools and colleges, perception of routes into careers and what careers, you know, count with the best one in the world? I always joke, when I went to my careers, I mean, this is, you know, hundreds of years ago, obviously, when I went to my careers library, they said that I should be an antiquarian book dealer, which I didn't end up doing. But talk to us about, you've designed, and it's, apprenticeships is a big part of your career mapping and sort of talent strategy at Virgin Money. Just tell us about, how long has it been there for? How has it changed? Why does it work? That kind of stuff.
Yes, so we've had apprenticeships in play for a number of years, and we've got a number of colleagues going through them at the moment, from, you know, entry level type of qualifications right through to MBAs. So we cover the full spectrum. In terms of how we're doing at the moment, I'll come to the schools question in a second, but in terms of how we're doing at the moment, so if we think about, you know, I was saying earlier, we're at that digital first future, you know, for our organisation. So everything we want to do is, you know, the first port of call is through a digital method. So for us, it was really understanding, well, what does that mean? What skills do we need that we don't have today? And how do we understand where those gaps are? So we worked really closely with particular business units who are already in that headspace and thinking and are developing the products and designing the customer solution. So we know that long term we need some of those skills. Digital skills is a really broad term, and it covers all sorts of weird and wonderful job titles that some of us will have heard of and some of us won't. So we work really closely with those guys just to understand what is it we actually need. And what we landed on is a cohort of graduate apprenticeships that we'll be bringing into our business in the next couple of months. There'll be about 12, 13 of them who will get a degree at the end of it. So it's a long-term piece of work. This isn't a quick fix for us. And they'll rotate through those key business units. So a little bit like a, you know, your traditional grad program where every 6 months you move around, but they'll be working probably in agile methodologies, because a lot of our work is done in that way. And they'll move through the business learning and obviously working for us. So they'll all get, you know, a permanent opportunity, and, you know, you develop your career and you learn. We get the benefit then of that, you know, real cutting edge thinking in terms of some of that digital activity and thinking that we maybe don't have access to just now, but we're relying on these guys to bring into us. At the end of their degree programme, they'll choose a specialism, and we'll secure a role for them that will then allow them to progress within that. The key thing for us here is to understand how we can then look at that long-term piece of activity that almost has to happen over here. What do we then do for the short term? So that's where we've been using the apprenticeship activity for upskilling, exactly as Robert was saying there, upskilling and reskilling colleagues who may be thinking, you know, I'd love to do something like that, but, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't know how to code, or I don't know what Java development is, or, you know, the real technical stuff. So we work then with our colleagues to give them those opportunities. And that's why we'll have this balance of apprenticeship activity that will be from an attraction perspective, you know, to bring people in, come work with us and learn and help us as we develop in our future ambitions, but equally for our colleagues who've got that real sense of who we are organisationally, understand our culture and can add to it. So that's how we've kind of built the program and how we've been working, and we're really excited about the next cohort, because I think it's going to be real sort of, you know, the first time we've, you know, moved into some of these areas that we've not looked at before. We're kicking off the recruitment for that literally in coming weeks, and it'll be open to internal and external colleagues as well. So we'll look to get a good mix and a blend. To answer the school's question, it's a tough one, right? Because I think there are still some expectations around routes into work. You know, I think there's that, you know, traditional academic route, and we see that quite a bit. We work quite hard with partners to kind of dispel some of those myths. So we'll do mentoring programs. We'll offer internship opportunities. We'll work with some partners that can give us access to that type of talent, where we can say to them, you know, you could still, you know, you could just come and work for us, start your career. You know, I think we've worked quite hard to take away some of the myths of the traditional banking career. You know, we're very much around technology, but all the other things that happen in our, you know, functional areas still need to happen, right? So you can have a career with us in HR like I do. You could be at the front line, you know, dealing with customers on a day-to-day basis, but equally you could be doing audit or something like that. So we've got that broad range, but we, you know, we work hard to partner with organizations to take away some of that assumption, and you know, that it must be that traditional route, because we don't believe that. You know, we very much hire for potential. We hire based on our values and behaviors. We hire based on, you know, the opportunity of having future talent in our organization. So but it's tough. It's a work in progress, and I think it's across all industries, not just financial services, where we need to continue to work with schools and the partners and organizations to take away some of that you know, so maybe more fixed thinking around how you get into a career these days.
Thanks, Lindsay. I can see Ian nodding along. Ian, do you have any particular pearls of wisdom about how to work better with sort of school leavers?
Well, absolutely agree with what Lindsay's been saying. I mean, just some practical ways in which we're actually doing that we can alert people to. So we have construction ambassadors going into schools up and down the country, and employers on the call today, if they want to get involved in that, they can just go onto our website at www.citb.co.uk to see how they can get involved. They go in based on a really suite of interesting digital material and content that enables them to really showcase the industry. I've mentioned Construct, but also what's really important is skills competitions in local communities. We're an active member of Skill Build, and also another thing that's really important for it as well is actually creating lots of opportunities to try and taste industries. I think it's the Gatsby Foundation that say that people only make their career choice after about 7 different experiences of workplaces. So that shows the challenge that we're up against. But just to say that, to do that, what we're going to be rolling out across the country is lots of taste experiences over the next couple of years, where people can come along, come onto a site, take some time on that site, see all of the different careers opportunities available to them. We've got a really successful on-site construction hub model, which actually enables people to transition into the industry quite quickly, but do that on site, experience it, get to understand the layout. And what we find is, for example, with apprenticeships, when people talk about apprenticeship achievement rates and increasing apprenticeship achievement rates and why people fall out of apprentices, they generally fall out because in the first 3 months they realize this really isn't for me. So it's all about that piece around pre-apprenticeships and getting that right and getting the relationship between the employer, the training provider, and the young person and their parents right. One thing to mention as well, it's not just schools, it's FE as well. We have a real challenge in the industry where only 40% of people taking construction related courses come into the industry directly after that course. And so what we need to ensure is that we develop really strong routes to ensure that pathway works and the skills system is responsive. I think often we can talk about people's awareness and careers and not actually look at the structures to enable people to get into the industry in a clear and simple way. We're working with government at the moment and industry, and are developing things called occupational traineeships, which you can currently start to bolt on to FE degrees to make sure that that work experience element, that trial with the employer, that connection between all of them is actually working. So lots of work to be done there as well.
That's brilliant, Ian. Thanks ever so much. There's a great point here from Robert West, which I think relates a bit to what Lindsay and Ian are talking about there, about the gatekeepers. So we've talked about school leavers and engagement with schools and FE just now from Ian, but the gatekeepers, so in Robert's words, you know, careers professionals, Department for Work and Pensions, work coaches, the people who can help you sort of advise and guide on how to, when you come to a sort of juncture, how you bridge that. Funny enough, I know it's not about me this morning, but we've had great experiences with an organisation called Multiverse, who started out as an apprenticeships organization. Now they offer training, and quite a number of our people, and not just young people, you know, junior people, senior people too, are taking their courses, where you have a set number of hours teaching. It's all done virtually, but the projects are all work you'd have to do anyway, so you get kind of double bubble. You're not having to think, oh, I've got to find a week, you know, to go off to a training center and do something. You know, it's all part and parcel. So there's some really innovative solutions out there. Robert, just tell us some of the things you've tried that haven't worked. I feel like that's a horrible question because we're all very positive and optimistic. But if you kind of got to throw some stuff at the wall and see what sticks. Has there anything you've attempted that hasn't been as successful that you would sort of say or steer clear from, or lessons you've learned, I guess?
Yes, of course. I think certainly the message from the top-down message about learning has got to be a very strong one. I think something we've adapted slightly in terms of trying to encourage people to do more training, making those sorts of right sort of messages in there. And you tend to find out that in some parts of your business you see great success. In others, maybe such as in manufacturing, where people don't have daily use of laptops, for example, where they're doing a particular job on a particular shift, that finding time to do learning is a lot more difficult. So having a single kind of message for your whole organization doesn't really work. You do need to kind of adapt your style to different parts of your business and very much where people work. So a consistent message is important. And we've got something now with a learning hours target. We've got 50 hours training that we want all of our employees globally to do in the course of a year. So that is a week and a half for the average full-time employee. That's the strong message that we've kind of learned from. It's, you can say the right sort of generic messages, but we thought, well, okay, we need to be a little bit stronger on this, and this is something that applies to everybody. And having a very strong kind of training and development system behind it is also important. Each country within Siemens was, tended to do its own thing, and there was a lack of consistency. If you're looking for a particular training course on cybersecurity or digital or whatever, a few years ago you'd find employees trying to go on the net and trying to find something. Maybe find something that's a bit expensive. It may not necessarily tailor to what the sort of skills you want people to have. So having that integrated training and development portal has been vital. So you can go on there, look at the details of your role and think, right, self-skill myself, what can I do here? What is this tool recommending me to do? But also if I think I've got to learn, how to build IT software in my job or something like that, you can go in on there and find some training that's relevant to learning in that sort of respect. So that's a key learning point that we've had there.
Thanks ever so much, Robert. I've got two questions. I think I might throw them to Matthew to begin with, but if anybody else knows the answers, please do jump in. One question has come in from Joanna Kerrigan, and I genuinely don't know the answers. She's saying that there are lots of solutions we're using every opportunity, but what we're coming up against is the de minimis funding limit of €200,000. Does anyone have a solution? Matthew, I don't know what that is. What do you know what that is?
No.
Does anybody else know what that €200,000 funding limit is? No, we've drawn a blank there. Joanna, I'm so sorry. We'll perhaps look into it after the fact and see if we can come back to you. And then there's another thing that I think is worth addressing, which is the lifelong learning entitlement question asked by Patrick Craven a little earlier on. Matthew, what is that and will it make a difference?
So what it is this is government trying to extend the system we are more familiar with around student loans for university degrees, and actually say, well, how do you extend that into technical education and so that you get an equivalent of what would be roughly 4 years worth of study if you were doing full-time post 18 education. But the idea is that you don't have to do it all at once at one point in your life. You can be studying modules, learning over time. Maybe you only need one module to be able to switch a career to a different sector, or maybe you just need to refresh and top up one particular skill at a time rather than do a whole, 3 year course or something. So the idea is a lot more agile and flexible, and it looks quite similar to the student loan system that we know and are more familiar with for university degrees. But it's just being started now. There's a public consultation on it, and the government hopes to have it set up by 2025. So my next stop after this webinar is actually a member meeting taking member feedback on the lifelong loan entitlement. So if anyone's watching, and there's still spots in tomorrow's session, if you want to sign up and tell us what you think about it.
So the idea is it's government money, effectively, that the individual applies for and borrows themselves, or does the company and employer borrow it on their behalf?
It would be similar to the way student loans work at the moment. So, yes, sort of government's the guarantor of the loan, if you like, but it is about individuals investing more in their own learning. So I would caution employers against thinking this is the way we're going to fund all of our skills needs in the future, because what we need is that to be a complement that helps individuals to invest in their skills, but we absolutely need businesses to be upping their investment too. Now, the lifelong loan entitlement might unlock some creative options for sort of co-funding some training. So we've seen in research we published a couple of years ago, one in four training needs that are going to come up in the next decade don't have a return on investment for the individual business that's doing it, but maybe if the learner could co-fund a small component of it, and maybe the business, because the business are often worried, what happens if I train someone and they leave?
Yeah.
Well, if the business is offering to pay off the cost of the course, depending on how long you stay with them, you might create that bit more of a market and unlock some more training that wouldn't have otherwise happened. But I think we do need to focus on making sure the lifelong loan entitlement is not about shifting the cost of training that businesses pay for at the moment, so individuals pay for it in the future.
Yeah.
But it could be a mechanism for unlocking some more investment, and hopefully some more investment from businesses too.
That's great. Thanks ever so much, Matthew. And we'll look forward. I'm sure there'll be another session on that specifically. There's the old adage, of course, isn't there? The business says, what if I train them and they leave? And then somebody else says, what if you don't train them and they stay? That's always a classic for the thing. We're in our last couple of minutes. I'd just like to go quickly back to our three brilliant experts this morning to get one piece of advice for people who are watching and are thinking, I know I haven't got the skills in the business that I need. Maybe they're thinking I need to change the skills of my existing staff. Maybe they're thinking I need to bring people in who have different skills. What would be a really useful tip of how to start this journey and make the best progress fastest? Robert, you go first.
I've tried to think of one. I could maybe think of two, I guess.
What,
yeah,
two
involve your workforce, consider the diversity of your organisation and working out what to do, and don't overcomplicate it. There's lots of different ways that you can train and develop with your staff, buy new people, build the skills, borrow people from other parts of your organisation. There's lots of different ways to do it.
Brilliant. Thanks, Robert. Ian?
Once you've done what Robert said, there's lots of funding available for you. It's hard to understand, but don't give up. Matthew mentioned the lifelong learning loan. In addition to that, within just the National Skills Fund, there's also skills boot camps that you can access. I mean, in addition to that, there's the free level 3 adult offer. It's out there. It's not well connected, but it is out there.
Great tip. Thanks, Ian. And Lindsay?
Absolutely agree with what both of the guys have said. I think for me, it would be remember that some things will be shorter term and some things will be longer term. So you might need to look at how you plan what your approach is going to be. So it could be upskilling current colleagues and then looking at, you know, using something like the apprenticeship levy for a longer term plan that maybe is 3, 4, 5 years away. So try and get the balance right on both of those things.
That's fantastic. Thanks ever so much. And like I said at the beginning, there are some good resources on the CBI website collected together, funding sources and advice and things like that. So that's a good first port of call if you're thinking about putting a bit of a plan in place. Thank you very much to our brilliant experts this morning, Robert, Ian and Lindsay, and of course to Matthew Percival from the CBI. I've really enjoyed it. I feel energized and optimistic and feel like I'm going to go and get myself some new skills. As I always say, please go put the kettle on, have a cup of tea before you dive back into your emails. And whether it's dull and dingy and rainy like it is here in London, or glorious sunshine like up in Glasgow, have a great rest of Wednesday. Thanks very much, everybody. Bye bye.